Well, you know what I think. I'm a Christian. I'm not going to deny that.
I do want everyone to feel comfortable. That's why I'd like to talk to you about Jesus.
Please do not go religious.
Somebody's going to hell over there.
He better not.
Even the devil will speak the truth for his own purposes.
This is war.
Accept it.
Back to Jerusalem podcast.
Yeah, I'm back and I'm armed with righteousness.
With your host, Eugene Bach.
He just seems like he's got it all figured out.
He's a righteous dude.
Yep.
Hello and welcome to another Back to Jerusalem podcast. I'm Eugene Bach, your host for this time, and I'm coming to you live on delay from somewhere within the borders of the Middle East. I just stepped off the plane from Sudan. I've been excited to share a podcast about what I experienced in Sudan because it was amazing. I wanted to do a podcast in Sudan. I usually do my podcast on location, but this time I just simply could not. There are certain countries when I go to, I don't take my electronics with me because I have records of different communications, and especially the reason that took me to Sudan kept me from taking my electronics with me because of the things that I've been writing for the last couple of weeks. I didn't want to get caught with those. I didn't know about the changes of Sudan. I'll get into that later, probably in a later podcast. But guys, it was phenomenal. Absolutely loved being in Sudan. I wrote an article about the 16 closed nations that are currently open to the gospel that you can travel to right now. If you're listening to this podcast, you can get on a plane and travel to 16 closed nations that are closed to the gospel but open to you. This is a time like none other in history. Americans, try to fly to Europe for your European vacation. Can't do it. Europeans, try to go to America because you feel sorry for the Americans and you want to spend some money there to bring up their economy. Can't do it. Right now, there are so many borders that are closed. We're seeing the UK in lockdown. Try to fly to Hong Kong or China. Our friends just left from the Middle East right before I flew to Sudan. And when they arrived in back home in China, 5 weeks lockdown in government hotels. 5 stinking weeks. I mean, it's getting nuts. But the good news is there are certain nations that you can travel to, one of them being Sudan. You can get on a plane right now and fly to Sudan, no quarantine, no masks, no social distancing, no rules. It's awesome. I absolutely loved my time in Sudan because of that. But one of the things that I saw, and I kind of want to share this a little bit because I heard this, and I was thinking about American politics, European politics. You got certain career politicians that have been in office forever. And I got a lot of Christian friends, especially those in America, that are talking about political reform and especially limiting the term limits of individuals that are serving in U.S. Congress. There's a term limit for the president, but there are not term limits for those that have been in office forever. You got one guy, Patrick Leahy. He ran for Senate in 1974 before I was even born. He's been in the Senate since then. You have Mitch McConnell, who's head of the GOP, if you're familiar with American politics at all, in the US Senate. He's been in the US Senate since 1985, and this does not include the offices that he held prior to being in the U.S. Senate. Dianne Feinstein, these are names that most Americans know right away, especially if you've been involved in watching politics or been involved in politics at all. Even if you're not in politics, you've probably heard these names mentioned before. Dianne Feinstein, 1991. And they're almost like leeches. They kind of stay in office forever. Joe Biden has been in government office since 1970. That's over 50 years in government office. Queen Elizabeth has been the ruling queen of the UK since 1952. So there are certain political, and I guess Queen Elizabeth wouldn't be political, right? Kind of this matriarch in charge of a nation has been, or charge of nations, those that are part of the Commonwealth. But in charge forever. Then I heard this story in Sudan. I had to share it with you guys. It was one of the first things. I have so many things to share about Sudan. I don't know if I'm going to be able to share them all because I feel like I'll be making certain people bored out of their mind if I talk about. There was so much. I've been to Sudan several times, worked in Sudan for years. But I'm super excited about Sudan now, more now than ever, because of what I'm seeing happening in the north. Guys, the north has gone through a massive transformation, especially since they got rid of al-Bashir. I'll be getting into that more later, but there was something that I've never done before, I've been wanting to do for a very, very long time, and I learned a bunch. Oh, I learned a bunch. Right now, guys, if you are thinking about doing missions or going to an unreached nation, now is the time. European borders are closed to Americans. American borders are closed to Europeans. Try to get on a plane and fly for tourism to Australia, South Africa, Asia. There are so many countries that Westerners have been loving to go to for a very long time, and they are closed. There are so many nations where missionaries have been scared out of their minds from going to, and those places are now wide open. This has never happened before. I can fly to Sudan easier than flying to Italy. I can fly to Sudan easier than going. Canada won't have me. Canada will not allow me into the country at all. Zip, zilch. UK, forget about it. I'm not allowed on UK soil right now. I don't have a good enough excuse. I don't have any family members. I don't have a UK passport. I'm not able to go to the UK, but I can go to Sudan. UK is a nation that has had Christian pastors and passionate evangelists and missionaries for centuries. But Sudan has not. And now they are open, wide open. And it was such a blast. Okay, so I'm walking around. I want to go for the, you know, I'm there. I got to have an excuse for being there. I can't tell people why I'm really there. I'm really there because I'm doing research for a book that I'm about ready to write together with a woman by the name of Miriam Ibrahim. I'm going to be talking about her on a later podcast. You can look her up now if you want to. She is a freaking soldier. No other Christian do I know of that's alive today that has done what this woman has done. I kid you not. Really, really amazing. So I go there and I'm doing research, but instead of doing research, I decide I'm going to do something I haven't done ever and I've wanted to do for a very, very long time. And that is to go and visit all of the different pyramids of Sudan. I had to travel all over the northern part of the country to see all of the different pyramids of Sudan. Most people, when they think of pyramids, they think of Egypt. But guys, Sudan has tons more pyramids and fascinating graves than Egypt. And most of you listening to this are like, what are you talking about? Most people have never heard of the pyramids of Sudan. Why? Because it's been closed off by the Muslim junta forever. And now is a time like none other to go and explore. And the great thing is I went there with nobody else there. I had the place to myself. And we're not talking about museums where you have to buy a ticket and walk in and look at things behind velvet ropes. I walked in, I touched, I saw, I did whatever I wanted. I'm not joking. There was nobody around. There were no guards. There was nothing. Nobody was around me at all. I could have taken a hammer and a chisel and literally lopped off big parts of the pyramid, put it in my bag and walked away, and nobody would have been the wiser. Because I was left alone. I didn't have a tour guide. I didn't have a guard. I didn't have an owner. I didn't have anybody with me. I had a tour guide that took me to the location, gave me a quick introduction, and then, you know, went away. Left me there for however long I wanted to be there, I could be there. Walking around, and these places are huge. It's not like, you know, got one little pyramid that you kind of walk around, like what you see a little bit of in Egypt. No, these are multiple pyramids all over the place, and it's just free reign, and there's nobody else there. I saw no other foreigners at these pyramids where I'm traveling. I'm going there, I'm all by myself, and I can stay there for as long as I want. It was so amazing. I had such a great time. But while I'm there and I'm talking about the history of the pyramids with one of the guides that is from this local area, and he tells me about a test that I've never heard of before called the Hebseb. The Hebseb test. When I heard about it, I thought this might just be the answer for those Americans that are clamoring for there to be term limits? Guys, this is your answer for term limits. I'm about ready to give you the answer for term limits. It's called HEBSEB. You can look it up. This is something that they did in Sudan for the pharaohs. So when you were a pharaoh, and so they had, so when you're looking at the Nile, right? The end of the Nile is Egypt. But the Nile actually starts, depends on whether you're talking about the Blue Nile or the White Nile. The White Nile and the Blue Nile are two separate rivers, two separate river systems that come together in Sudan. And then most of the cataracts are found in Sudan, which are the different levels of the Nile. So you kind of got these like steps or almost like a small waterfall or rapids, if you will, because basically you're starting at a higher elevation in a place like Uganda, which there you have Lake Victoria, which is one of the main sources for the Nile, and it flows downward into Egypt, which kind of, I don't know why, but it's counterintuitive to my mind. I have always thought of the Nile flowing southward. And I think that's because I always think north higher, south lower, right? But that's not the case for Africa and the Nile. The further north you go, the lower in elevation you get all the way up until you get to the ocean. And so the lower Nile is north. It's the most northern part of the Nile in Egypt. And so you're starting off on this higher elevation where you got these two river systems. And I was right there at the two river systems of the White Nile and the Blue Nile coming together. And along the way, this is the former Nubian Empire, and you've never heard about it before. And the reason most of you have never heard about the Nubian Empire before, it is one of the most wealthy, most powerful empires in the world. But it was Christian. And when the Muslims took over, when the Muslims came in with their jihad and began to attack, they were not able to overcome the Nubians. So what they did, what the Muslims did that wanted to take over the Nubian Christian Empire is that they began to intermarry, was able to do immigration into the Nubian Empire and then take over from within. And it was brutal. It was violent. The Nubians even tried to give over treasure every year just to keep the peace because they were superior on the battlefield. They were some of the best archers ever. They also conquered Egypt. But they didn't want to war all the time. So they paid a certain tax to the Muslims to keep them at bay. And the Muslims were not able to overtake them. So when they finally did, after a very long time of being able to basically infiltrate, outnumber them when it came to birth ratio within their own empire, once they finally did take over, they erased everything. They went straight after the history, destroying everything. Libraries, teachings, churches, anything that had to do with Christianity, they needed to get rid of it because it wasn't the Muslims, it was the Quran. The Quran, which is a seed of Satan himself, and Satan needs to get rid of that history so that people don't remember their history. I sat down with a guy that was talking about in schools how people are starting to learn English in Sudan. And so he told me, but we don't want to teach our kids too early English. And I said, oh, really? Why? Because, I mean, that's what they do in Sweden. They start at a very early age. And he was like, well, because we don't want to get rid of the people's heritage. I said, what? Don't want to get people. Do you think the indigenous language for Sudan? I didn't say this to him. I just, okay, yeah, all right. But do you think the indigenous language for Sudan is Arabic? The indigenous area for Arabic is kind of found in the name, the Arab Peninsula, for the Arab people. It's not an African language. It's not their heritage. And the people of Sudan have been sold a load of crap to tell them that their heritage, religion, and language is Arabic and Islam. And it's not. Christianity came in with evangelists that were willing to sacrifice their lives to share the gospel, and the people embraced it. Not at first, there was persecution, but it wasn't conquered by the Christians. There wasn't a military movement that came in. There is an Axum kingdom in Ethiopia that did conquer them, but that's not how they became a Christian nation in Nubia. There were three different nations along the upper part of the Nile that became believers because of the sacrifices that Christians made in the areas. And so the people decided that they would embrace Christianity because the truth always wins. Always. If you are able to give an equal presentation of the truth, there'll be some morons that will reject it. And all right, they have the freedom to do so. God allows them the freedom to reject it. So do I. But Islam is a lie. So it cannot allow you the choice, because any smart person is going to choose Christianity over Islam, because Islam, the so many things about that religion are counter. It's the exact opposite of intelligence. Look at any nation that follows Islam. Actually, their universities suck. Their ability to develop new materials, and so many people will be like, oh, well, did you know that algebra is started? No, algebra did not start among the Muslim nations. That was a trickle-down effect from the nations that they conquered and took over. When Islam started off and they began to do this jihad and take over places like Persia, places like Egypt, places like Nubia, these places were a wealth center of knowledge. You had individuals that were both Christian and Jewish and local indigenous religions that were really good at astronomy. They were really good at medicine. They were really good at writing. They were really good at communicating. They were really good at maths. They were really good at sciences. They were making discoveries and breakthroughs left and right. They were keeping libraries of all the stuff that they were able to discover. And so when Islam came in and they were able to conquer these areas because they focused on war and they became very, very good at it and they were demonically led, that allowed them to the power to overpower these different regions. What happened is a lot of this knowledge, this understanding, then poured over into the next generations of Islam, each generation becoming weaker and weaker in its understanding and its knowledge until finally it died out. That's why these nations that are today hardcore Orthodox Islam don't have the, that's why they have to keep saying, well, did you know way back then it came from then? No, it didn't. It came from the people that they conquered. It was an influence of the people that they conquered. But it slowly died out. It squashes intelligence. But I was looking at this Hebseb that they had for the pharaohs of Sudan. And this is a test that the people had to go through in order to maintain their leadership over Egypt. And I started to see this and I was like, dude, there are so many people right now that would love this to be in place, especially as for those of you that do not like the current president, you're going to love this. For those of you that have a problem with Joe Biden, you're going to love this. For those of you that don't like the Queen of England, you're going to love this. I love the Queen of England. I'm a big fan. But still, I think that this is quite funny, this Hebseb, because it was a physical test and a mental test and a spiritual test. That if you were the Pharaoh, you didn't just become the leader forever. The people were like, okay, listen, you know, you're going to be the leader. We think that God has chosen you, but we think that we kind of need to do a testing on your mental acuity. You don't get to be the Pharaoh forever. So they gave this Hebseb test. And this Hebseb test, you had to, the reason they called it a Hebseb was because it was the representative of a dog or a jackal, where the Pharaoh would literally put a tail on like the jackal and then have to run around his palace, or there was like a track that was set up where the Pharaoh would have to run and make a certain time. Like if you're fat and you're gonna fall over dead, you're not gonna make this Hebseb test. If you're overweight and you've just been gorging yourself on food all day, every day since you've been in power, the people are like, you know what? We don't think that you really focus on what it takes to make a great nation if all you do is sit around and eat. If you want to just gorge yourselves on all the enjoyments of life, we have an issue that maybe you may not be our best leader. Or if you get up in front of a microphone and you babble all day and what comes out of your mouth is not exactly coherent, we might not think that you are the best person for the job. And so we have set up a test. And the test is just to see, are you still physically fit? Are you still tip top when it comes to your mental acuity? When it comes to your spiritual understanding of the Egyptian gods, do you still know what's going on? And so they were given a test. And they had to submit to the test. And if they failed, if they were fat, if they couldn't make the run, if they couldn't pass the Hebseb, it's like the SAT for pharaohs. If you couldn't pass it, then you had the obligation to do your nation honor by killing yourself. When I was going to these pyramids in Sudan, I learned that the majority of pharaohs that were buried there died by suicide. Because that was the honorable way to go when you were no longer fit to lead. There was no retirement plan. Your retirement plan was in the grave. So I started to think about this, and I thought about, you know, do we have something that's similar in the ministry? Like, are there certain pastors that are in charge of churches that, you know, probably could use a good run around the church? Pin a tail on them and have them run laps and time their laps? Are there certain pastors that get up and start to speak and what comes out of their mouth really doesn't make any sense whatsoever? Should they be sent out to the pasture? Should they be forced into retirement? Is there a certain age where pastors become an embarrassment? Start looking at Martin Luther. Martin Luther led the Reformation of Europe, right? I mean, you have the entire Scandinavia is all Lutheran. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland. These are all Lutheran nations. We have Protestants today all around the world because of an initial movement that was led by Martin Luther. But the things that came out of his mouth, his anti-Semitism, when he was older, was something that would put Mel Gibson to shame. He proposed, I don't know how many people know this, so I just want to read this off really quick, because most people don't know this. Martin Luther wrote 7 things that Christians should do to guard themselves against Jews. He proposed what he called, "What shall we Christians do with this rejected and condemned people, the Jews?" That's what it was called, and there were 7 recommendations that he gave not long before he died. So he's older, seems to be a little senile, or at least that's the excuse that we give when anybody ever brings up the fact that the anti-Semitism that came out of Martin Luther's mouth was embarrassing for all of the Protestant believers. Number one, first, says Martin Luther, need to set fire to their synagogues and schools. This is to be done in honor of our Lord and of Christendom, so that God might see that we are Christians. Yeah, that sounds like a really Christian thing to do. Going, let's go burn some schools for little Jewish children. Second, I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed. Guys, I'm quoting. I'm reading this directly. Third, I advise that all their prayer books and Talmudic writings, which is such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy, are taught, be taken from them. Fourth, I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on pain of loss of life and limb. Otherwise, if these rabbis teach, you tell them you're going to dismember them or kill them. Fifth, I advise that the safe conduct on the highways be abolished completely for the Jews, for they have no business in the countryside. This sounds like it's straight from the Palestinian handbook. Sixth, I advise the usury be permitted to them and that all cash and treasure of silver and gold be taken from them. Seventh and final, I recommend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a distaff, or a spindle into the hands of the young, strong Jews and Jewesses, and let them earn their bread in the sweat with the sweat of their brow. But if we are afraid that they may harm us, our wives, our children, servants, cattle, etc., then let us emulate the common sense of other nations such as France, Spain, Bohemia, etc., and eject them forever from our country. This is horrible. And it's the exact opposite of what Luther said when he was young. In 1519, when Luther was still a young, vibrant leader of the Reformation, he said, "What Jew would consent to enter our ranks as Christians when he sees the cruelty and enmity we wreak on them, that in our behavior towards them, we less resemble Christians than beasts?" Meaning that what Jew would join us because our actions against them have been so reprehensible. So in his younger years, the days when he was more in tune with his thinking, he taught very strongly that the Jews are to be loved and evangelized. In 1523, he wrote an essay that was called "That Jesus Christ Was Born a Jew." That's the title of it. And he condemned the inhumane treatment of Jews and urged Christians to treat them kindly. Luther's fervent desire was that Jews would hear the gospel proclaimed clearly and that they would have an opportunity to become Christians if they wanted. But these writings, these anti-Semitic, horrible, evil writings, he did in the 1540s, right before he died in 1546. Which leads me to ask a question. Do we as Christians need to have some sort of hebseb for the leadership, the older people, for the church? I think that there were a lot of people applauding when they thought of the idea of those that can't coherently put it together a sentence should not probably be leading nations. I watched my grandfather pass away a couple years ago. And in his older age, just before he died, he said horrible, horrible things. In fact, he removed my mother from his will. He only had two children, my mother and my uncle. And he told my mother that, and she's the only one that really had a relationship with him. My grandfather never had a relationship that was strong with his son because his son was not a very good person. He did a lot of things that brought his parents grief over and over again, as did my mother, but not in the same way. And none of us are perfect. But right before he died, it was almost like he found a bit of enjoyment by telling my mother that she's been removed from his will because of the husband that she chose. My mother was widowed and then married and divorced several times, and the husband that she most recently is married to was never approved by my grandfather. My baby sister, who I'm the closest with, was also she found herself having to listen to the rambles of my grandfather that were very hurtful. And he basically told her that he thought ill towards her because she was the product of a man that he never liked. And of course, I don't believe that he meant that for a second. But in his older age, he began to say things that were hurtful and harmful. When I began to think of this, I started thinking about Ronald Reagan, one of the greatest presidents in many people's minds to ever live. And as a U.S. president, I didn't even really know that he was still alive in the 1990s. Because starting in 1994, Nancy, his wife, basically hid him from the public. And from 1994 until 2004, when he died in 2004, Cameras never saw him. Journalists never interviewed him. Nobody outside of the most intimate people that were hand-selected by Nancy herself were able to meet with Ronald Reagan. And the reason why is because in his dementia, in his Alzheimer's, he was saying things and doing things that were not in his personality. And she, as well as her thoughts, what he would want, what Ronald Reagan would want, is not for the world to know him in those later days. So I started to think about this. And then I was taken to a verse, Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not grow faint. I believe very strongly that if you have breath, God has a purpose for your life. You may think that as you get older, you are growing more senile. You may think that as you grow older, people can no longer benefit from the things that you have to say. And I would say that the Bible contradicts this idea of a Hebzeb. Though it was fascinating to learn, and though it was fun to play around with the idea, and kind of, you know, I've never really thought about this before, especially in terms of term limits, right? But then I started to think about the sovereignty of God. How we are born at exactly the right time in exactly the right place. God did not make a mistake when he had you to be born where you were born, with the parents that you were born with, in the land that you were born with the culture, the language. Everything about you was specifically programmed to adequately represent Christ wherever you go in life. And if you are not representing Christ, every day that you're alive is a window of opportunity to start. And the day that you're calling, your purpose is finished, is the day you draw your last breath. I believe that life is valuable and called by God, that we have a purpose, whether we see it or not. And for every day that we are alive, God still has a plan for us. Our greatest days are not behind us, but ahead of us. This is interesting that Isaiah chose to use this idea of wings as eagles. But those that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength, and they shall mount up with wings as eagles. It's interesting because eagles have a bird with one of the longest lifespans among all the other birds. Eagles typically live between 20 and 30 years in the wild. And I've heard people say that in captivity, they can live up to 50 years. They are apex predators, and they are relatively long-lived compared to other birds. They're one of the oldest living birds on the planet. And there is a story that says that an eagle, when it gets to the latter part of its life, it has a problem because its feathers no longer hold it in flight like it used to. Its beak begins to curve in a way that no longer allows it to grab its prey the way that it used to. Its talons become a bit deformed and no longer allows it to grab the prey the way that it used to. And so during this time, during the latter part of its life, the eagle finds a secluded spot and goes back to its nest. Nests for eagles are only used for rearing the young. Eagles do not use their nests as homes. But this is the place that the older eagles, before they die, go back to, these nests. And there the eagles find a hard place to bang their beak against until the beak falls off. and the talents fall off. And this is absolutely critical to eagles because their ability to catch and consume food is impossible without their beaks and their talons. No eagle can survive without them. But then, once they get rid of the old, the new talons grow back. The eagles start plucking their old feathers. And the eagle then has to survive 150 days without food. But during this time, its talons grow back, its feathers grow back, and its beak grows back. And after about 5 months, the eagle takes flight. And this famous flight is called the rebirth. And after the rebirth, the eagle can live for another 30 years. Have you ever heard about this before? If you have, it's completely false. I looked it up. I was so moved. I was like, this is like the best story ever. I'm going to so include it. And then I looked it up and I found out from the experts that it's complete BS. Not true at all. But what I did find out is that eagles do go through a type of rebirth. It's just not as dramatic as pinging their heads against a rock. I felt so stupid when I heard a professional was like, no, the beak is a part of the face. It doesn't just fall off. It's bone structure that is covered with a type of like fingernail type of material that grows over the skeleton, but it doesn't. It's not you don't just break off the skeleton and then the skeletal feature grows back. But there is a rebirth stage where you can go onto YouTube and you can find bald eagles pulling out their own feathers. And the feathers, this renewing of the feathers is what's called the molting of the eagles. And during this molting stage, during the latter years of the eagles are able to remove their feathers, the old feathers, and they grow new feathers. And these new feathers on these massive eagle wings, which span 7 feet long. If you've never been up close to an eagle, they are freaky creatures. I saw them on TV. And when I thought about them as, you know, a large bird. Dude, they look like a dog on their hind legs when you're up close to them. These are massive. A wingspan of 7 feet on these things, that's huge. They are intimidating creatures. But these bald eagles pluck out their own feathers during the latter years. And those feathers grow back during this molting stage. And on these new wings with new feathers, some experts say, and this I verified, that they become better in flight than in the earlier stages that they had in their life. And I don't think it was by accident that Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31 said, they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength, and they shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. I had a good friend. His name was Dale Kaufman. And Dale Kaufman lived very close to me for several years. And I used to go over and visit him, and we would spend time together at their house and sometimes at restaurants. And we hung out with him. He's the founder for King's Kids for Christ, an amazing servant of God. And he used to give this analogy of a spear. And he said, during the younger years of your life as a Christian, you are the tip of the spear. You are the piercing agent. And those that are older lead you and guide you. So if they lead you and guide you astray, you become the piercing agent for that which is evil. If they're good, godly men, then they can lead you down the right track and you become the piercing agent for good and justice, righteousness, and love. When you are middle-aged, you're like that shaft that keeps stability. The stability between the arrows in the back and this tip at the front. That shaft is like the middle age of those that are in the heat of everything. They're raising families. They're taking care of of bills and making arrangements for their parents and making a foundation for their children and their families. And that's the busiest time of their lives. All of the hopes and dreams that you have when you're younger, you start to forget about them in that middle age life because you're so busy. You're going to PTA meetings and soccer practices and staff meetings and Monday morning meetings and big sales and big crashes and homes that are upside down in value and bankruptcy and credit card bills and elections and all of these different things hit you when you're in that middle age life. But believe it or not, you are the stability for your children and your parents. You provide this kind of rock formation that provides the income from your taxes for all of society. You are the major wage earner. Those that are older than you, they start to go into retirement and they have to live on a meager salary that is only a fraction of what maybe they used to make when they were younger. You now have to continue to pay for your children as they are in school and they are going through university and they are starting in life. Maybe you help them with tuition. Maybe you pay for their first house. Maybe you help them with their first car. Maybe you help them get married and you pay for all of the wedding expenses and their honeymoon. You are the financial stability for all of society when you're at that middle age. But the stability and the tip of the spear have big problems when the feathers are off kilter because the feathers represent the older generation that give us direction, that keep us on point. Old men don't rush to the front lines in the military, nor should they. It's the young men that have no experience. It's the young men that have energy without the brains. It's the young men that have all of that testosterone that are ready to charge at a minute's notice, but don't know what they're charging for. And it's the older, the wiser, the experienced that need to be able to set the battle plans that make sure that the younger don't give their lives in vain. That they're not throwing themselves at the tips of the enemy spears for no reason. That they are able to make the most of their life, their vitality, their muscle. If you are alive and you are older, you provide that direction. Your experience is absolutely necessary. Your life, your knowledge, your wisdom is desperately needed in the world today. You want to know why things are so screwed up in the West? Because those that lived through the communist revolutions of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s are not around to tell us how bad it actually sucked when communism took root. Just read a book while I was in Sudan by Richard Wurmbrand, Tortured for Christ. This is, I believe it's absolute, if you are listening to this and you've never read Tortured for Christ, stop this podcast, go on to Kindle or Amazon and buy it ASAP. He gives us the kind of information that we need in a younger generation from the older generation's experience. If you are alive, you have a purpose to lead, guide, inform, consult, send out. You're not retired. There is no retirement in God's plan. There is no Hebseb in God's kingdom. You have a purpose. God's retirement plan for you is death. If you are still alive and you're not dead, that means you still have a calling on your life. You know when you can rest? When you croak. When you bite the big one. Until then, keep fighting. Until then, keep punching. Don't screw over the next generation by letting them think for themselves. Don't screw over me by not helping lead me and guide me and those like me. If you are of an older generation, I need you. other believers need, desperately need you. Well, they don't want to listen to what I have to say. That doesn't keep you from saying it. If I don't listen to your advice, then I be damned. Because the older generation has pearls of how the enemy has attacked us in the past and will attack us in the future. And if you share your experience from what you went through in the past, it will help me for the future. What do you think the Bible does? The Bible is the voices of those that followed God and those that did not follow God from the past generations. All of those stupid mistakes that you made when you were younger, I need to know about them. And I need to know about them in all their embarrassing glory. I need to know how you failed miserably and how you don't want me to do the same thing. See, the enemy right now is telling people around the world to hide those things that we did that were stupid. They're saying that, well, we need to tear down these statues because they're racist. We need to tear down this person's works because it was racist. We need to tear down this person's information, their building, their legacy, because they were sexist, because they were anti-Semitic, because they owned slaves. I'm telling you right now, if you were a slave owner, if you were a racist, if you were sexist, if you were anti-Semitic, I need your guidance. Why? Because my hope is that in your later years, you have learned how stupid you were. And when you hear the same stupid crap coming out of my mouth, when you see me doing the same stupid stuff that you did when you were younger, you can say, hey, Eugene, dude, that's not the way. If you walk the road that I took, you're going to end up in the same horrible place that I ended up. History, bad and good, teaches us. That's why the enemy wants us to get rid of it. That's why the enemy so desperately wants to destroy it. When I look at the Bible, I see the two pillars of my faith, Abraham and Moses. You don't get more, of course we have Jesus, right? But Jesus is God himself. But when we look at the major religions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, these are all the Abrahamic faiths coming from the Mosaic writings. Abraham was the founder of the faith. That's why we call him Father Abraham, right? Father Abraham and many sons is Father Abraham, right? And I am one of them, and so are you. I haven't sung that forever. I can't believe I remember that. But Father Abraham is absolutely essential to the founding of our faith. And his promise didn't even start until he was 100 years old. God told him that he was going to have so many people in his lineage that they would be uncountable like the stars in the sky. Which is like the best calling ever, right? I mean, I'm sorry. Some of us have been called for other things in life and they are miserable. But Abraham's job was to create children. That's your burden, Abraham? Your job is to create children. I mean, that's like one of the best callings. I mean, I don't have to paint you a picture of what that means in practice, right? I mean, if you're not having children, you get to keep trying. Oh, poor you. What kind of sacrifice is that? I mean, let me get this straight, okay? You have people that are called to die in battle. You have individuals that are called by God for suffering and dying and to bleed on the battlefield for his kingdom's sake. Some of those that God called had to go to prison, like Peter. Peter was hung upside down on a cross. Paul, beheaded, and had to go through all the crap that he went through trying to take the gospel, which he was called to do, into all these foreign lands. Thomas was massacred in India And who knows, while in India, what kind of bouts of Delhi belly he had to deal with before. I mean, I've been to India so many times and had to deal with Delhi belly. I mean, there are times where I would have begged for somebody to kill me with a spear and let me be martyred in India and Chennai like Thomas was. Jesus had to hang on a cross and was crucified. And Abraham's calling was to make kids. I'm sure when Jesus got to heaven, he was like, no, Abraham, don't even tell me about how you suffered. How even as an old man, you had to keep trying to have kids. But he's a rock star of the Bible. And many times we forget his age. Those that wait upon the Lord, they renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not grow weary. Moses didn't start leading the Jewish people until he was 80 years old. So many people want to retire 15 years before that. And Moses didn't even start till he was 80. No, guys, there's no Hebseb for us as believers in the Bible. So no, I don't believe that you should ask your pastor to run around the church and make a certain time. And I don't think that he needs to pass a certain mental acuity test, but I do think those that are older can be a benefit to us that are on the battlefield today and can benefit from that wisdom, that knowledge, that experience. They shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run not be weary, they shall walk and not faint. I want to thank you so much for joining us for another Back to Jerusalem podcast. Again, I'm Eugene Bach, your host for this time, and I'm coming to you live on delay from somewhere within the borders of the Middle East. God bless you.